This podcast does not constitute financial or investment advice. It is for educational, general information, and entertainment purposes only. Please consult with your own financial advisor before making any financial decisions.
I think 2% of all funding globally goes to females, and we know that statistic because Harvard did this incredible study on the topic. And what we learned from that Harvard study was the exact same sentence they did in a female voice as opposed to a male voice was received differently in the ears of decision makers. And people heard a female voice say something and they had negative connotations, nervous or too demanding, as opposed to humble or confident. And they didn't have as much confidence in their ideas and their beliefs.
You're listening to Banking on Girls, the podcast that explores the importance of financial literacy for girls and young women. And I'm your host, Marina Batmiwala. Join me on this journey to uncover insights and inspiration. Hi everyone, my guest today is Elizabeth Rossiello, the CEO and founder of Azure Finance, a fintech company which is accelerating global access to frontier markets through an innovative infrastructure. Before founding Azure, Elizabeth was a rating analyst for microfinance institutions across sub-Saharan Africa, consulting for the Grameen Foundation and the Gates Foundation, as well as working with regulators on legislation for financial innovations. She previously co-chaired the World Economic Forum's Council on Blockchain and has been a guest lecturer and keynote speaker in digital assets and fintech for the University of California at Berkeley, Oxford University, and MIT Sloan School of Management. She holds an MA in International Business and Finance from Columbia University. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much for having me.
There is so much going on in the world of financial technology, or fintech as it's called. And I saw a statistic that you quoted that only 1.5% of fintech founders globally are women. Why do you think that is? And what are the barriers to entry for women?
Yeah, well, this statistic is all too real. And I believe it's way lower for women of color. And I think it is very hard for females in finance in general. And I spoke about this widely on another podcast with Bloomberg recently. And I think it's very hard for females in tech. And when the two combine, it's difficult. I think 2% of all funding globally goes to females. And we know that statistic because Harvard did this incredible study on the topic. And what we learned from that Harvard study was the exact same sentence they did in a female voice as opposed to a male voice was received differently in the ears of decision makers. And people heard a female voice say something and they had negative connotations, nervous or too demanding, as opposed to humble or confident. And they didn't have as much confidence in their ideas and their beliefs. So if we know that from the Harvard study, then that goes to show that when you are founding a business, all of the people you need to convince along the way, employees, regulators, partners, counterparties, clients, it's harder every step of the way. And I think that's one of the big issues. I think another big issue is that if a woman decides to start a family, unless they have a supportive partner or they can afford childcare, paid childcare, or a family member, then they really struggle to balance the two. And, you know, making that decision is hard for all women at work, but especially for founders where we have a very difficult work schedule.
Right. I think that sums it up very well. The statistics on private capital going to women are just astounding, even in developed countries. And then when you marry that with, you know, the barriers to entry for women in financial and technology careers, I mean, it's just exacerbated. So you're a very rare person and you're an American living in London. What led you to focus your fintech business on the continent of Africa and the work you're doing there?
Right. So very early on, I left home. I'm from New York City. And I always say my first time leaving home was when I went to a middle school and a high school 90 minutes from my house. And I had to take a bus and two trains each way to get there. And it was quite a journey for what I thought my parents thought would be a better education. So I've always kind of been traveling for seeking out what I wanted to do. And I left New York and moved to Germany. And I worked in Germany right after I graduated my undergrad. And I went to Switzerland. And from there, I decided I was fed up with regular traditional finance, investment banking, and the way I was treated mainly as a woman. I was very, very hard. I was, you know, a lot of sexual harassment, a lot of undermining my work, a lot of competitive, difficult behavior that didn't make sense to me. I have an analytical mind and I was writing a lot of research and doing a lot of analysis. And I didn't understand why we couldn't just talk about the analysis. Why are we talking about what I was wearing or, you know, who I was dating or, you know, I just found it very frustrating and very confusing. And so I looked for a job with a development organization that was doing something different and working with women. And I found one working with microfinance groups in Kenya. So I moved down there. So again, I just kept following my interests academically and professionally. And I didn't really stay put when I felt uncomfortable. And, you know, when my boss was not appropriate or my colleagues were toxic, I just kept moving forward. And I eventually found a very fulfilling job and a lot of really interesting work doing field work and working with a lot of organizations focused on females.
That's how you got to know the continent of Africa. And then at some point you transitioned to your own business.
Right. So I was working doing these microfinance ratings. So every month I was sent to a new country and I was newly married and my ex-husband at the time was also traveling for work. So we both were, you know, 25, 26 years old and every month would go to a new country to do a new mission. And it was very exciting and a lot of interesting things. But then when we had a child, I ended up having to find work close to home. I found it very difficult to continue to win consulting contracts when I had this child. And I remember we each went for the same project at one point and they said, well, you have a kid. And then I had a second child the next year. And I said, well, my husband also has kids. In fact, he has the same kids as me. So already, I think as a woman, I was like, huh? I think as a mother, I found this entire new wave of prejudice. And I was like, there's more. I haven't already experienced it. You know, now that I have kids, people are questioning again, my ability to write research reports. How? So I really struggled and I found some really cool work with the Grameen Foundation and then with the Gates Foundation, but nobody was looking to hire me full time. Even these women focused organizations were run by men. And I found it very strange that even organizations dedicated to the promotion of female empowerment were run by men who were questioning my ability to do my job. So I finally just got very frustrated and started my own business. And I thought it was just a way for me to stay employed. And little did I know that it would grow into this business almost 10 and a half years later, where we employ almost 250 people and process billions of dollars a year.
Okay. So you mentioned microfinance. Perhaps you could explain what microfinance is and the business that you've started now.
Sure. Microfinance was begun in Bangladesh, and actually it comes in many places in Germany, in South America, in West Africa. We see this traditionally. You might know it as community lending or group lending, where, you know, 10, 20 people, usually women, would take out a loan together and share it. And then each work to pay back their portion of the loan. That's one way that it goes. Another way is that women contribute to a savings pool and alternate who gets to take it home at the end of the month. That's called a merry-go-round. There's many different ways this works, and maybe communities around the world for hundreds of years experience this, maybe with a quilting circle or a church group or a school program. And it was really formalized and commercialized by a company called Grameen Foundation in Bangladesh. And the founder of that, Muhammad Yunus, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. And that's when I heard about it. And it became the fad in finance, where it was you could invest in these microbanks. And as an investor, you could still make money, but do good. And you saw all this money globally go into it, even with Kiva, which is a website where you can, as a young investor or a parent, invest a small amount. And there's many websites like that that do these kind of lending, micro lending. It became quite big. And so when I entered the sector, I was hired to write research reports about each institution to make sure they were doing things correctly and that they were using the money wisely. So that's what I did. And when I started my own business, I really was based off that, where I said, one of the big problems is that these microfinance institutions, these micro lending, are getting their money, getting their own business money from North America or Europe. And it's coming in dollars and euro, but their loans are in local currency. So not to get overly complex, but there is a foreign exchange mismatch where you're lending in dollar and you're on lending in Uganda and Chile, and the exchange rate changes during the course of the loan. And all of a sudden, the microfinance institution becomes over indebted and it can't pay back the loan because the dollar has strengthened against local currency. And I found this very irresponsible, and I was really frustrated, and I thought it was very wrong for a lot of these donors to do that. And I wrote a lot of reports about it, and I talked about it, and I wrote some research on it. And when I started the company, the idea was that we would start to trade local currencies against each other, and we wouldn't always need to borrow in hard currencies. And so that grew into running a foreign exchange platform for African currencies.
How does this help the women who are taking out these loans from the microfinance institution?
Well, I mean, that's just one aspect of it. We work with really big remittance companies. So MoneyGram works with us, and PayPal, TransferWise, also corporations, other lending fintechs, banks, lots of players in the market trade through us for the foreign exchange. And we reduce the cost, we increase the speed, and we make it more efficient. So it's easier to trade in African currencies. And the idea is they used to call, or they still do call, African currencies exotic currencies. And that's a problematic word in a lot of ways. And one of the ways it's problematic is it scares people away. And when you're scared away, things become more expensive and things become less efficient and the consumer suffers. So we decided to normalize that by trading in these currencies and showing that it's easy and accessible to trade in them.
So breaking down those barriers. One of the other interesting things in your background is that you co-chaired the Blockchain Council at the World Economic Forum, and you've traded in Bitcoin. It's been so much discussion around Bitcoin in the last year or two. Can you explain what Bitcoin is, how it works, and what your role was on the Blockchain Council?
Sure. I mean, that's a lot in one, but Bitcoin was the first cryptocurrency or digital currency. And a little over a decade ago, it was created. And we like to call it digital money. And yes, you know, a credit card or Apple Pay seems like digital money, but that's actually just a digital version of a government money like the US dollar, et cetera. This is like your Monopoly money or your game money being real. It's not owned by anybody. It's not owned by the US government. It's not owned by the French government. It's not owned by the Chinese government. It's owned by a computer program that a lot of people participate in. And so it's actually moves differently. It gains in value differently than the US money does. It goes up and it goes down. Some people get scared of that and they say, oh, there's no control. I like my money owned by the US government. I like my money owned by Visa or MasterCard. I don't want a money that's not owned by anybody. But if you think back to when credit cards began or when private banking began, it was the same situation. It was money that was held outside of the US government. So I think, and we've seen in the history of time, lots of community currencies that have come and gone. And I think what's interesting is this lets us trade and use its money on a lot of the things that we like now, like digital games, e-commerce, online apps, mobile money platforms. This digital money works really well with the internet. And it really works a lot better than credit cards, which get rejected or get scammed and things like that. It moves very easily and it's easy to integrate with because the code is similar. So people like actually having this money that's built for the internet. And I think it's really exciting because especially in the early days, it was quite open, meaning you can find a lot of the source code and the computer code of how to work with these wallets and use this money online. And even if you're, you know, a young woman who's looking about it online, there's so much information online and there's so many places where you can play with programming it. And you're not able to do that with like a Visa or a MasterCard API. And you certainly aren't able to play around with moving the United States dollar around. You know, you would need to create a bank for that. So I think it's really exciting for young people. I think it's really exciting for the future of how we use financial services. And there's been a lot of hype about it. But to this day, that's one of the most exciting components of it.
Great. Thanks for that explanation. Who or what were your early influences when it comes to money and finances?
Interesting. I mean, obviously, it's where you grow up. I grew up in a community full of first and second generation immigrants in America and in New York City, melting pot. I think my neighborhood in Queens, New York, is the council, or I guess you'd call it a borough or the district in America that has the most languages spoken out of anywhere in the United States of America. And so I grew up with a lot of hardworking families who were working, like my own dad, two or three jobs to make ends meet. Nobody had really nice things. And, you know, I started working as a babysitter and, you know, a camp counselor at like 12. And so in earning my own money, I think the idea that no one was going to do it for you. I mean, I had amazing, incredible parents who, you know, were the first in their family to go to college and graduate. And in a lot of ways, we're the first pioneers. I think the work ethic was really there, not only from my own family, but from my community. And I was actually went to a high school that I told you I traveled for, where people were very, very wealthy. And I saw an inordinate amount of wealth. And from an early age, I think I got used to seeing the difference and realizing everybody was the same. And it couldn't be true that some worked harder, because nobody worked harder than the people in my neighborhood. So how could they have so little and other people who didn't seem to be working that hard had so much? So I really thought a lot about how is wealth distributed and how do we earn money? And I don't think I equated wealth with intelligence or goodness for a while. And I think that served me well, because I realized later in my career, I'm a technocrat or meritocracy. I really believe in we should earn what we generate. And I think opening doors to let people have access to show what they can do and rewarding them for it fairly is something that's very important to me.
So is there anything that you know now that you wished you knew about money when you were younger?
I think I wish I had started investing earlier. You know, I didn't know a lot about that. Also, I mean, I didn't have a lot of money to invest. I was making ends meet for a long time. I remember I was working as an intern. I was working as a babysitter. I was a student. I had my first job. I would ride a bicycle between all four. You know, I think I would like to know also maybe when I was married that it's okay to have my own accounts and it's okay to save money myself. I think I didn't understand that as a wife, I had to do everything my husband said. And it's funny because sometimes when we're very good at what we do in at work, or we feel like we are very smart or, you know, analytical, we feel sometimes we have to compensate. And I think that at home, I didn't really act as independently as I would have liked to. And I think it's funny to say that as a modern, you know, 40-year-old woman, you think you're being so independent, but I think the legacy of what I saw growing up and what women were allowed to do stayed with me. And I hope my daughters going forward remember their independence, even when they go into relationships, and remember that it's okay to be independent and it's okay to be in a partnership, but most importantly, to make sure your needs are taken care of and to think about everybody's benefit and not to do that. So I think that's something that I really lost for a long time. And it's funny because so many women who work have almost like a secret life at home or vice versa.
Yes. And the two things that you mentioned come up over and over again, even with very successful women. Wish they'd started earlier with investing and possibly with saving, and then just maintaining independence. Very, very important lessons. So you have two daughters. What are the most important money lessons you're teaching them?
I have two donors and a beautiful bonus daughter with my partner now. And I have three teen girls in my life who are 11, 11, and 12. And we talk a lot about the value of work and something which they don't take for granted, I hope, but something which I talk about all the time is the invisible work of women. And so if you're not going to pick up your plate or you're not going to do that thing at school or in the restaurant, or where are women working around us and we don't value them, and a babysitter or a cleaning woman, and are they being paid fairly? And back to what I said earlier, just because they're not driving the same BMW that the man next door is driving doesn't mean they're not working as hard and we shouldn't be respecting them. So not to always equate money with value of life and humans and, you know, work, and really see where that hidden work is and how can we bring justice to that. So I talk a lot about what things cost and what work went into it and was it fairly valued? You know, is a low-cost chicken or a low-cost item of clothing, what hidden work was put into that?
Yes, I attended the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women just last week in New York, and that was one of the major issues in the world is the value placed on caregiving, which, you know, is a lot of the work that women do in the world.
Yeah, and you know, even this morning, how much work did I do before I got to work?
Right.
You know, and we don't talk about this, and you know, we don't accept it, and we certainly are not sharing it equally. And I think hopefully my daughters have gotten an earful. They're like, Mom, enough. I bring it up.
So finally, Elizabeth, what advice do you have for people raising girls in today's world?
I think we can't underestimate the need to talk about life and to talk about what's happening. And we need to talk and share. I think so many of us who are my generation were raised in silence. And so many of us, even when I was dating recently after my divorce, so many people I dated said, well, these aren't problems anymore. And I was like, my own peers still to this day. So even colleagues, until they come to a meeting where they see it. So I think we need to tell our daughters, this world isn't exactly fair yet. And we hope it gets there, but it's not right now. And what you're seeing and experiencing, not a hallucination, it's happening. And, you know, we can accept it and work towards something different. And, you know, we can see that at all levels, whether it's gender or race or orientation. Or I think it's really important to talk about what's happening and where we are in it. And if we don't tell this to our girls, then they'll absorb it in silence. And I know I talk a lot as a New Yorker, but I hope my daughters one day hear those voices when they have to make choices for their own life.
Wonderful advice. Elizabeth Rossiello, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Banking on Girls podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate the podcast and be sure to hit subscribe or follow so you can receive notifications of new episodes. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and at bankingongirls.com.